This is Lars. Thanks again for checking out my podcast. Enjoy your day and the show, and let's make America great again. Are you approaching retirement, or maybe you've just changed jobs? If so, you'll probably now have control of your 401k or IRA. Would you like to buy some property, notes, loans, start a new business, or even buy crypto? You can with a self-directed IRA. For more than a decade, I've been telling you about setting up a self-directed IRA through IRA Advantage. And while you may now hear other companies say they offer self-directed IRAs, you need to find out if they're truly self-directed. With a truly self-directed retirement account, you can make any investment the law allows. Whether you're talking about true diversification, starting your new business, or investing in private holdings, IRA Advantage through a truly self-directed IRA can make that happen. Take it from me, Lars. You've worked hard for your money. IRA Advantage will work hard to keep it yours.
Would you like to learn more about truly self-directed IRAs? Then visit IRAAdvantage.com. View our videos and call IRA Advantage. That's IRAAdvantage.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Conspiracy Theory Thursday. It's a pleasure to be with you live on the Radio Northwest Network. We now serve, I think it's 24 stations in three different states in the Pacific Northwest. And we talk about the issues of the region, and I'm always glad to make it a conversation, you know, a dialogue instead of a monologue. So if you want to jump in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you want to vote in our Twitter poll, you can find that at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Today, I want to ask you this. Would you send your kids to a college that now requires race indoctrination to graduate? In this case, it's Portland State University, which is now requiring that to graduate from PSU with a degree, you must take one of the following courses to know that your racial indoctrination is complete. You have to take race or ethnic studies. Courses in that category include Introduction to Black Studies, Black Feminism and Womanism, Chicanics, it's spelled with an X, Labor History, Prejudice, Privilege, and Power, and queer families. So any one of those will satisfy the requirement. Would you send your kids off? And more importantly, would you send your tuition dollars off to a college that requires racial indoctrination? In other words, indoctrination that tells you that America is an unforgivably and irredeemably racist, systemic racism country, and that you have to get that to be able to graduate. I mean, it used to be that they did their indoctrination of kids at college relatively quietly. These days, I think they're just putting it right out in front of everybody because they know there are not going to be too many people who are going to question it. But I'm going to question it. And in fact, I'd question any parent who would say, why, yes, I'd send my son or daughter off to a college that requires that they be racially indoctrinated, especially in a predominantly white state. If the kids are white, the students are white, and they're going to be told, you're bad. You're bad because of the color of your skin. You are part of the oppressor class. If you want that kind of indoctrination, are you going to pay good money to get it or try to find someplace else to send your kids to school? Today's Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, yesterday, and it sounded almost as crazy as today's Twitter poll, although we write up these questions from the news of the day. That ensures, number one, that they're fresh and relevant. And number two, you may not have heard about the stories before, but yesterday I started out talking about how the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare is now creating a porn literacy curriculum. And you say, oh, well, they teach all kinds of crazy things at college. No, in Idaho, this is not for the college kids. This is for elementary school age kids down to third grade or about 8 years of age. They're going to require that your kids be literate when it comes to watching or reading or consuming in some way pornography. And I said, does that make sense? So yesterday's question was, should public schools teach porn literacy to your elementary age kids? I said no to that idea. So did 96% of you. Only 4% of you said yes to that idea. And I would love to hear from those naysayers. As you know, on this program, naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, since it is Conspiracy Theory Thursday, I don't always arrive on Thursdays with a good conspiracy theory, but this one I've been telling you about for some time, literally years, that the Northwest is going to be stripped of its ability to generate enough electric power to keep the lights turned on. Now, some of you actually had the lights turned out in the last couple of weeks. In that case, they said it was, well, it was a preventative measure to make sure that fires were not started by the power lines, even though the Pacific Northwest has seen literally decades in which we rarely have a year where we don't have some part of the summertime where we have extremely hot conditions, extremely dry conditions, and lots of fuel that might be set fire. And they didn't turn the power off then. And a lot of you said, well, was turning the power off necessary? There's actually no way to prove one way or the other. But that's one question. In California, they're already starting to run short of electric power, even as the state is pushing, you must buy an electric car, you must take your home to electric, we're going to forbid natural gas-powered furnaces, we're going to forbid natural gas-powered water heating, and all the rest of that. But what's happening here in the Northwest? Today, I'm going to predict that outside of this show, most of the other media you hear is going to be celebrating something very, very strange. You see, there's a major coal-fired electric plant. I mean, it's already been shut down. We're no longer getting electricity from it, but now they're literally going to blow it up. It is the Boardman Power Plant. It's out near Umatilla, and they're going to explode the big towers that are near it that would carry the exhaust from that plant. The plant only started in operation in 1980. It got retired about 2 years ago, long before the end of its useful life. And by the way, in your power bills, you're paying for that. It's kind of like cash for clunkers. Remember the old program under Obama where you took perfectly good automobiles that still operated and had them crushed down to nothing in exchange for a few bucks from the government? Well, in this case, when they crush this power plant that stopped generating about 2 years ago, you get to pay the bill, because you're losing something that's of value, and it's literally being blown up. It used to generate 585 average megawatts every day. It was also, they said, the state's largest source of climate warming pollution. Now, by that, they mean CO2. Well, the people in the state actually exhale CO2 as well, and a lot of us who are more sensible do not view CO2 as a pollutant. We view it as plant food. In fact, it's such good plant food that all the pot farmers like to enhance the CO2 in their greenhouses so they can grow better pot. Not that I'm a fan of pot. But in any case, they got rid of that plant. They also got rid of one of the two coal-fired plants that operates in Centralia, and they plan to get rid of the other one as well. And they've got 10 more coal-fired power plants, most of them outside of Oregon and Washington, but they feed electricity into the region. In fact, coal is about 26% of the electricity on the state grid. And they say, well, we're going to get rid of it. And if you ask a sensible question, if you get rid of a quarter of the electric power that's available in the region, what are you going to replace it with? Well, you're not going to build new dams. In fact, they're still talking about tearing out existing hydro dams. And you can't do natural gas because the greenies don't like natural gas either. You see, how about wind and solar? Well, wind and solar, well, wind's about 7% of the grid right now. So somehow they're going to have to make up that other 26%. Here's my conspiracy theory Thursday prediction. We're going to run short of electric power. And we're going to be told that it was necessary to be able to save the planet from global warming. All the while, the Chinese communists, who actually produce many of the consumer goods, most of the consumer goods sold in America, they are building coal-fired plants every single week, about an average of one new coal-fired plant every week. So the cool stuff you're buying, including the windmills and the solar panels and that cool new cell phone that you got, the ones that are coming from China, they're being made with coal-fired electricity. But here in the Northwest, we're going to shut it all down. And when you end up in the dark, that will be the end of my conspiracy theory. Glad to be with you on a Thursday. Always glad to get your calls. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense. Right. You're bloody well right. You know he got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Well, if Kamala Harris can't come to the border, then the border can come to Kamala. Earlier this morning, two buses carrying 100 illegal aliens pulled up at the Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C. That happens to be the official home of the Vice President of the United States. It serves as a good slap of reality to cackling Kamala about the realities that too many Americans face during the deadly and very expensive border invasion that her boss, Joe Biden, created. A year and a half ago, Biden was feeling the heat on the illegal alien crisis, so he named Kamala Harris his border czar. Since then, the Veep literally hasn't visited America's border even once. Last weekend, she even had the chutzpah to tell Chuck Todd that the border is secure after he asked her about the 2 million illegal aliens who've crossed into America in just the last year. The vice president is either blissfully ignorant of the facts or lying or a little bit of both. Probably the latter. In any case, a harsh dose of reality showed up on her doorstep this morning. Men, women, and children toting backpacks and blankets sent there on a bus, or two buses actually, by Texas Governor Greg Abbott. Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis made sure that America's uber wealthy did not miss out on the fun. He sent a couple of plane loads of random illegals to Tony Martha's Vineyard, home to Barack Obama's multi-million dollar seaside mansion. You kind of have to wonder how a guy who's predicting the rise of the oceans would decide to spend $14 million on a house right next to the ocean, but that's a subject for another day. Elites like those should get a taste of the damage that you do to a great country when it has no borders, and they might just end up in your neighborhood. Andrew writes in about Slow Joe's voting carbon footprint, which is a big one. Holy carbon footprint, Lars. At great public expense, President Biden flies to Delaware for an hour to vote. He was there last weekend on vacation. He could have easily voted then, but then again, he was on vacation and he didn't do anything. I wish he'd go on vacation again. America is much safer when Joe Biden is not at work. And David Garcia writes in and says, Lars, I love the fact that a few strong Republican leaders are sending illegals to sanctuary cities and especially to the areas where the Democrat leaders live. FJB thanks David Garcia. And on Twitter, Ty Lemon says, there are 10,000 unsolved murders in the U.S. last year, and the FBI is reading the text messages from the pillow guy. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you
ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
The way has been paved by Trademark Paving. Just pave it. Serving Southwest Washington.
I'm going to award today's Daily Grill on the basis of a note I got from Kathy. She wrote, Lars, we have a serious problem occurring in Southern Oregon at Griffin Creek Elementary School. The Medford School District has seen fit to employ a non-binary teacher to teach six-year-old children without any parental input. This happened after there was an overflow and class size needed to be adjusted 2 weeks after the start of school. Students moved to this new classroom are distraught as to why they can't address the teacher as Miss, Mrs., or Mr., as well as a number of other issues. Parents have requested transfers back to their original teacher. They have been flatly denied by the principal and the Director of Equity and Inclusion. What is this position for? A six-figure paycheck, maybe? This teacher goes by Slytherin on social media, the bad guys from the Harry Potter movie. Her classroom was decorated with black rainbows and evil red eyes, which I understand have since been removed. My guess is they were evidence removed to save face. Why is it acceptable to bring this to any classroom, and especially to impressionable six-year-old minds? A group of parents, grandparents, and extremely upset people plan to attend the district board meeting this evening to voice our opposition and the fact that they work for us, the taxpayers. Can you please help us out? I'll at least bring some attention to is what I wrote back to her. Kathy, thanks very much. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. And actually today, I decided to put two in front of you. They're brought to you by Mobile Joe's RV Collision. Get back on the open road and back to your adventure with Mobile Joe's. No body damage, too big or small, collision or paint repairs, Mobile Joe's RV Collision fixes them all. Rick Kaiser writes in from Oak Harbor. Lars, since Patty Murray, U.S. Senator, does not want to debate, Tiffany Smiley should do one of those Clint Eastwood-style debates with an empty chair, like Clint did a few elections ago. Rick, I think that's a great idea. And Miguel Ullenkott writes to me and says, Lars, I was listening to your show yesterday on the introduction about porn literacy for kids as young as 8 in the state of Idaho. Disgusting. And the towns listed on the North Central Idaho District, the town mentioned, which I pronounced Kamaya, is actually pronounced Kamiai. There's another town about 7 miles east, Kuskia, which is pronounced Kuski. Also, glad you and your family were able to take a vacation at Silverwood. We went there a couple of weeks after you did. We love the place. Got to get back to work. Take care, brother. Signed, Miguel. To your calls now. It is Conspiracy Theory Thursday. I'm glad to get your calls. Let's start with Joe in Maple Valley, listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Do you know what the cause of global warming is?
Natural causes. I mean, if you want a short answer, natural causes. In other words, global warming and cooling has been going on for literally thousands of years. Actually, if you want to know the truth, tens of thousands of years, because both of us live in a place that used to be part of glaciers because of the last little ice age ending and warming starting about 20,000 years ago. So the real cause is Mother Earth herself.
You know what Earth's precession is?
I do. It's where the angle of the Earth in relation to the sun changes over time, correct?
Over a 26,000-year period of time.
Correct. Yep.
Jupiter also has an attraction to us, which causes us to go into an elliptical orbit, depending on where we are. And the life ages come every 100,000 years and go away over a period of time. Right now, the northern hemisphere is leaning towards the sun and getting a lot more sunlight.
And by the way, Joe, all of that is to the average person scientific trivia. Do you know what the meaningful part is? Does man play any significant role in global warming?
Very little.
Right. And yet, right now, we're being told, I started by talking about one power plant that's literally being blown up because it's fueled with coal, and how the region that now gets a quarter of its power from coal, both inside the region and outside the region, is going to cut its own throat by cutting off that power without anything to replace it. So the significant thing is, while the rest of it is very interesting, especially to science nerds like you and me, the part that's important is, does man have any significant contribution? The answer is no. Is the U.S. now cutting its own throat by refusing to use the energy that it has? Yes. Are our biggest competitors on the planet still using coal like China? Yes. Is that going to end well for the United States? I think the answer is no. I'll give you the last 10 seconds.
One more question is, what's the second most predominant liquid on the planet? And that's oil, crude oil.
Second most? Second most predominant. After water, is it oil?
Yes.
I would imagine that's true. And we ought to use every single drop of it. We ought to de-oil the earth to whatever extent we possibly can, and it'll provide great fuel for human beings on this planet for at least the next 100 years, and we'll have something to replace it by then. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And if you judge Joe Biden's performance on the things that he has managed to double in this country, he hasn't doubled employment. He's doubled the cost of gasoline. Now it's dropped back down, but he did double it for a time, and it's almost double the cost it was when he took office. And now he's managed to pull off something that you might have said was impossible. I'll tell you what, we'll throw down the dare. Can Joe Biden actually make the cost of home mortgages double in price? And it turns out that he's managed to do that as well. Now, I know that's bad news for lots and lots of people. I'm not laughing about it. I'm saying this is the kind of disaster that this guy has brought to America. And I'm waiting for Americans to wake up to it. I thought the best guy to talk about super high mortgage rates is my friend Nick Shivers. He's one of the many supporters of this program and his real estate business, the Nick Shivers team. Nick, welcome back.
Always a pleasure to be here, Lars.
Now, I've been saying for the last couple of months that mortgage rates have almost doubled just from January to present. January, they were just above 3 points or so. You might have been able to get a smoking deal just below 3 percentage points. Now, the number for the first time in 14 years has topped 6%. I want your estimation of what that's going to do to the mortgage industry and the home building industry in this country.
Well, let's just take, for example, in January, let's just say you put 10% down on a $500,000 house. your mortgage payment with PITI was about $2,400 a month. The same house, same down payment is going to cost you $1,000 more a month. So with inflation, you add housing prices now. I mean, Lars, that is troubling for the market. And that is why, you know, I don't see us seeing a home value crash. But for a total sales volume, right now, since May, we're down about 25 to 30% in transactions.
Yeah, and what I worry about mostly is Joe Biden and the Democrats are constantly telling us why we look out for the little guy out there. Now, for your more well-heeled clients, they might say, well, an extra $1,000 a month, Nick, that's going to be an inconvenience, but we've got the money. But I imagine there are some people out there who just fell off the edge of the I want to buy a house table.
Yeah, first-time home buyers are getting crushed. And the second thing is, Lars, it's not any better on the rental side. Rents are going up, and that isn't going to change when people aren't selling their houses. So we got an issue with affordability, and it's a big one.
Well, and in fact, let me add to that, because I don't know how we calculate this number. But let's say there's a certain percentage of people who've spent their, you know, maybe the last 5 or 10 years saving up and planning that someday we're going to get a house. So in the last 9 months, basically, they've gone from we can buy a house to we simply don't have the money. Even if we did, the bank wouldn't let us buy a house. If those people stay in the rental housing they're in, that makes the rental picture even worse, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, think about it. If you could afford a $500,000 house in January, and that was the most you could pay, is that $2,400 a month? Now you can afford a $355,000 house. And Lars, there's not a lot of $355,000 houses currently in the market.
Although who knows, maybe there will be after this happens, because we all know that there are people who come to you and say, Nick, I got to sell my house. I'm moving. I'm being transferred. Circumstances have changed. Would they put the house on the market in this kind of situation where 6% money is the rule now? What's that going to do to them? What are they going to have to do to sell that house?
Right. I mean, we are going to definitely see a price downward inflection. Now, again, just because of the lack of inventory, because, Lars, this is affecting builder costs. This is affecting everything. So the issue that we're seeing is we are seeing the demand is there, but the viability of people being able to afford it continues to shrink with interest rates going up. And there's a really good chance it's going to go even further, because our inflation numbers aren't looking that much better, because, you know, Uncle Joe, he's continuing to say that he's going to get this inflation under control, but it's just not working. And the only way the Fed has anything to do, they're going to continue to raise those rates. And this isn't going to get any better anytime soon.
You know, I told Nick, just as a small picture, I know that the contractors get a better deal than somebody like me does, but I had to go buy some 20-foot 2x6s the other day, and I only needed a few of them. They cost $50 a piece. $50 for a piece of lumber. I mean, it's a good-sized piece of lumber. It's 20 feet long, and it's 2x6, but $50 a board to buy that, I can't imagine what that. And then let me ask you a question about rates again. When we see the home mortgage rate top 6%, it went to 6.02 this week for the first time in 14 years. Should I also assume that the kind of loan you get from the bank to go out and build a house, you know, the construction loan, which is then, you know, transformed in some form into a home mortgage once the house is done, but you have to borrow the money to pay the contractor to build the house in the meantime, are those rates going up as well and just as badly?
Yeah, across the board. And remember, the risky thing is those construction loans need to go into permanent loans. And when rates continue to go up, you might be able to afford it then. But if rates go up another 1%, I mean, that's a 10% decrease in what you can purchase. So the other aspect that we're not thinking about is unemployment issues with the mortgage industry, with the title industry, with the real estate industry and construction. I mean, things are going to slow down, and you start adding that unemployment issue, then, but I'm a positive guy. I think we can turn around. Lars.
I'm a positive guy, too, but what I'm worried about is the rates will come down when the economy crashes so much that well, you say, of course, money's easy because nobody wants to borrow at this point, and so the rates go down. The other piece to this is, though, What happens? If you had a client who said, I want to get a bare piece of land, put a house on it, we'll get the construction loan, we'll do all that, and then we'll turn it into a mortgage. Is that process maybe 6 months from start to finish, or is it shorter than that?
No, I mean that. You mean it's the process with also the city of Portland issues with permitting. I mean, the process is could take you 18 months.
Okay,
Yeah.
Well, with permitting, but say you've got permits in hand, you're turning dirt on the site, you're building a house, it takes you 6 months. If the construction loans are higher now, and now we've seen mortgages go to 6 points, if you get to the end of that and they say, and the bank says, okay, the house is done, now let's turn it into a mortgage. And you say, oh, well, when we started building the house, we could have afforded the mortgage. Now we're not going to qualify. What happens in that case? You've got a finished house that you borrowed money from the bank. You're supposed to pay that off with the mortgage loan, and the bank is telling you, you no longer qualify to occupy and have a mortgage on the house you just finished building.
The qualifications, more than likely, you'd be safe.
Okay. Well, I'm just wondering. I mean, if the bank says, yeah, you qualified at 6 points, but now that it's 7 or somewhere higher, you no longer qualify. So you own a house, and you owe us a whole bunch of money, but you can't actually get a mortgage on it.
Yeah, that would be a big problem. And that is where you start seeing the distressed sellers, Lars, which, again, that isn't happening right now. But if those things, with the flip of a 1% increase in interest rates, that affects that monthly payment, as we saw, $1,000 more than January of the start of this year, and affordability goes down. That's when people start putting more and more homes on the market, and that's when we see values continue to go on the downside.
Brace yourself, folks. It's going to be a rocky ride. That's Nick Shivers, one of the great supporters of this program, but we reach out to him when we want to talk about what's happening with mortgage rates and houses and things like that. Rates above 6% for home mortgages right now. First time in 14 years. Another first for the great Biden administration. FJB. Back in a moment. I'll get to your calls on this Conspiracy Theory Thursday. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network, serving Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. Our Twitter poll today, and I mean this seriously, would you send your kids to a public college, a government-operated college that requires race indoctrination in order to graduate? Portland State University has now said that to graduate with a degree from PSU, you must take something in the race and ethnic studies area. Courses include queer families, introduction to black studies, black feminism or womanism, Chicanics, labor history, prejudice, privilege, and power. If your kids don't take it, they can't graduate. Would a mom or dad, a sensible mom or dad, send their kids to such a university? Today's Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. To your calls now. Let me go first to Ron in Salem. Ron, would you send your kid to a college like that, or did you?
Hell to the damn no. My godson down there in Cal Poly Pomona had to go through next 2 years, those classes. They're offensive. I read the material. It's like segregation with a taste of socialism mixed with communism. It's a bad seed. If I can't put the Ten Commandments in the school, if we can't have open debate, it's an indoctrination program, basically, to make our kids become emasculated, because of race. And I mean, my godsons, I got 28 families, 42 godchildren. I don't know why they were like Uncle Ron.
You've been a busy guy.
Ron. This, when you make lifetime friends based on the character, even I tried to kill my best friend 4 years ago with a pitchfork. It's funny, but nevertheless, we love because of truth. We have foundation founded by our faith, and with history as a guide of the past so we can preserve the present, how are we going to give our kids a future if we forsake all of the true history, not this socialist ideology that because you're a European American or whatever, and you think that we should cater to the in BIPOC bull sugar and everybody else. It's just, Lars, we got to fight back starting in our schools. We got to get people out of the churches and into the Department of Education, at our colleges, at our universities, take all the high places that the Lord said until he come back. And if we don't,
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, here's the thing. I hope that the alumni of all these colleges that push this stuff, when the college reaches out, as they do all the time, to people who've graduated from that college and say, hey, would you like to make a donation? You say, no, I won't make a donation. And on top of that, I'm going to tell all my friends who often give to whatever college it is that's asking, don't give them a dime. This is how they're going to use your money. And that's probably the only way to get at it. Let's go to Chris. Hey, Chris, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. Thanks for listening in Coos Bay. What's on your mind?
Yes, I wanted to go back to your comment about the coal plant.
Yeah.
And it makes me kind of curious that in Marion County, we have the Covanta incinerator.
Yep.
And then in Umatilla, back in 04, they built an incinerator for the chemical weapons that were stored there.
Yeah, the Army did it. I've been out to the plant. I've been to the plants that where they pioneered the technology. My understanding is at the end of the demilitarization of all that nerve gas, the law said they had to dismantle the plant and it could not be used for civilian purposes. Now, I disagreed with that. I thought that's stupid to spend all that money to make this high-tech incinerator and then say, and at the end of it, you have to dismantle the thing and send the parts off for reclamation. It made no sense. But what were you looking to do with that?
Well, if the technology to burn trash in Marion County that may have batteries with mercury in it or any other nasty chemicals, why can't we use the same technology to make coal burn clean?
We could, and we can. But, Chris, you have to approach these greenies as though you're approaching somebody, and I'll say this as a Christian, and I'm a true believer in Jesus Christ. So if somebody comes to me and says, well, you know, I question your beliefs, you say, fine, that's your choice, but you're not going to rock my beliefs. When you go to greenies and you say, can't we use coal in a sensible way? Because China's using coal, and I guarantee you they're not meeting the kind of standards that the EPA already requires in this country. They're going to tell you, no, you can't. And I'll tell you why I know that for a fact. The fact is that when PGE decided to get rid of the Boardman coal plant, they said, I'll tell you what, we're going to, instead of burning coal, we're going to burn something called switchgrass. They were going to grow thousands and thousands of acres of this grass and turn it basically into nuggets. So it would have been carbon neutral because you're growing it and then you're burning it. Well, if you grow it and you let it rot, the gases get released anyway in the form of methane. So it's carbon neutral. They tried it. It didn't work. They tried wood mass. It didn't work. And then they said, well, how about we use natural gas? That's really clean compared to coal. It's dramatically cleaner than coal. And the greenies said, nope, we won't let you do it. In fact, in California's most recent power emergency, when they said, well, we're going to have rotating blackouts and all that, the governor finally had to give emergency authority to even fire up the natural gas plants. So if you think these folks are going to get behind the idea of burning anything, even something as clean as natural gas, you're mistaken. It's not going to happen. The greenies will not allow it. They won't allow nuclear. They're certainly not going to let you dam more rivers. They want us to freeze to death in the dark is at least my theory on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. Lars here with a question for you. Why is it that some people aren't as stressed out about the future as you'd think they would be? The answer? They're probably among the millions of Americans who prepared themselves with emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. If the worst ever happens, literally millions of American families are already protected from dealing with those empty store shelves. Is yours? Mine is. If not, go to MyPatriotSupply.com right now and grab some emergency food kits, at least one for every member of your family. These kits give you a wide variety of delicious meals that average over 2,000 calories per day. That's what you need. Everything stays fresh for up to 25 years in storage. Order your kits right now by going to MyPatriotSupply.com. Your order ships fast and arrives discreetly in unmarked boxes. Listen, this is something you need to jump on now before the next news headline stuns the world. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. One of the drugs that is regularly and routinely killing Americans is a drug called fentanyl. And where does it come from? Well, there are actually two answers to that. One, most of it is produced in China, but then it has to get into the United States, which it can't do legally. So most of it goes to Mexico and then comes across our wide open border, courtesy of the head of the Biden crime family, Joseph R. Biden. It comes into the United States, and between fentanyl and heroin, we are now seeing well over 100,000 overdose deaths a year. And if you only count about the overdose deaths, it's bad enough already. But then you have to count all the people who do not overdose, but use the drug routinely, and it ruins their lives and probably the lives of people around them. And one of those people is Jody Miller, who wrote to me and said, Lars, as the recent mom of a 21-year-old fentanyl addict, I'm reaching out to you to get your help. This epidemic has gone on long enough. Too many of our young people have been lost to this horrible drug and other opioids. Ms. Miller, welcome to the program.
Hi, Lars. Thanks for having me.
You have this in your family, and you described the situation involving your son. What happened? And you also talked about a real clear-cut failure of the medical system, that even after your son managed to get off the drug, the system almost tried to put him back on it. Would you mind describing all of that for me, please?
Yeah, absolutely. His addiction actually started with an injury that led him to the emergency room. And in that course of action, the physician that, I won't say treated him because he didn't, that saw him that day, just pretty much, you know, threw a prescription for OxyContin at him, and we were off to the races with his addiction. There was no recourse, you know, it was just push him on down the road, and it was up to him to, you know, try and figure out how to navigate fixing the actual problem. Mm-hmm. In the course, you know, of several months down the road, you know, he had had a car accident that led him to the emergency room again. Actually, let me back up, because there was an emergency room visit in between there. And I now know that this was either a reaction or a possible overdose of the fentanyl. And this led him to the emergency room, in which I was with him at that time. And with no tests, nothing at all, they were suspecting either a stroke or an overdose happening. And what did the doctors do? They pumped him full of Dilaudid. And then when he said, oh, that's not touching my pain, they instantly gave him fentanyl. When they brought that in, Lars, I was like, what are you doing? You have no idea what's happening here. And you're just throwing drugs at this kid. I'm telling you, as his mother, I'm suspecting this is drug related. And you're going to give him fentanyl? I was so shocked. And the doctor's like, well, it's safe. Are you kidding me right now? No, it's not safe. This drug is literally killing 150 people per day in the United States, Lars.
I've watched the numbers. I guess one concern I've got is, Jody, I've been in the emergency room with family members. When somebody's in intractable pain, what should they do in today's environment if the drugs they're giving them for the just to get the pain under control, what should they do instead? Just say, we'll give you enough to take the edge off it, but tell you what, you're just going to have to deal with the pain. Because my family members are, you know, for the most part are scared to death of Oxy. You look at it and say, I'm taking either none of that or as little of it as I possibly can get away with because of the addiction concerns. Now, not everybody is like that, but if they've got somebody in front of them who's in intractable pain, how do they address that? You know, what should the doctor do? Say, deal with it. We'll give you something to take the edge off, but other than that, we're not giving you anything heavy duty.
You know, Lars, I think sadly, with the way that our healthcare system is now and as broken as it is, ultimately that really is the only option that we have.
I kind of suspected it was.
Yeah, these drugs are so easily accessible everywhere anymore, and they're killing so many people that we just can't have them manufactured. We can't have them. And you brought up our borders.
Well, I bring it up because, Jody, you know that when they give fentanyl to somebody, it's under doctor's care in an emergency room. They don't send you home with it. They will if you're, say,
right.
a cancer
right.
patient. They'll give you a patch, which you put on, and it releases
right.
it very slowly. And then the addicts chew the patches, literally chew on the patches. It's disgusting and grotesque that a human being would behave
yep.
that way. But that's what they do. So...
Yep.
You know, in cases like that, fentanyl does not kill people when it's used under the doctor's orders and used the way the doctor said. What should we do to fix this, though? Because you're right on the front line of it. I'm not. But I have the same concerns. If I got hurt badly and went into the hospital and they gave me oxy, I'd say I'm taking as little of this as possible and for as short a time as possible, because I don't want to get addicted either.
You know, they do have other medications that they can prescribe. I mean, they've had other medications. You know, I brought up Dilaudid. That's, you know, an excellent alternative. It is a short-acting medication, but a very large percentage of the population respond and react very well to Dilaudid.
Right.
A lot of doctors use that as an alternative.
In honesty, Jody, I'm going to ask you a blunt question. Do you think maybe your son didn't react, the Dilaudid didn't touch his pain, because he's been on opioids for a time?
Oh, I have no doubt about that. I have no doubt in my mind about that. I don't necessarily even think that he had pain, to be honest. I think, you know, in the situation that he was in, on that particular visit, I'm, you know, very skeptical that there even was pain. You know, and which is another concern altogether as well, because with our healthcare, the way our healthcare system is, especially after the induction of the Affordable Health Care Act, access to care it's a joke, and a lot of people have to use the emergency room for their primary care and things like that. But, you know, you also have these addicts who are constantly using emergency rooms as, you know, they're drug dealers.
I'll tell you what, we're going to hit a break here in a moment that I have to take, Jody. It's a hard break. Would you mind staying with me?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Jody Miller is with me. Her son has been a fentanyl addict. She wrote to me and said he's a fentanyl addict. I want to talk to her a bit more about this, and we'll get your phone calls and your emails, too, at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers, as always, go to the head of the line. And if you want to send an email, it's talk@LarsLarson.com. I've been talking to Jody Miller, who wrote to me and started by saying is the recent mom of a 21-year-old fentanyl addict. And we've been talking about that. Jody, we kind of brushed past, you mentioned that I had mentioned the border. The open border is probably the biggest contributor to what's going on with your son right now, other than, as you've already identified, some of the actions of people in the medical care system. You sounded like you wanted to say something about that open border or my comment on it. I'm curious what you'd like to add.
The border actually is a huge problem with this epidemic, Lars. And, you know, I could probably scream from every rooftop in the world, and I don't think the current administration would, number one, care, or number two, you know, do anything to change that. But we absolutely have to lock our borders down. You know, the drugs coming in, it's just, I just can't even believe that the drugs alone are not enough for our government to realize what an open border is doing to this country.
I take it you didn't vote for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris.
No, Lars, I did not.
No, nor the sanctuary state governors of Oregon and Washington. You didn't vote for them either.
No.
Yeah.
No.
And see,
no,
and that, and that's the problem. You've got a vice president who just had 100 illegal aliens dropped on her doorstep this morning by the governor of Texas. And Kamala Harris sat right there on television last weekend and was asked, what about the 2 million people who came into the country illegally in the last 12 months? And she said, the border is secure. It's as though they've decided that's the line we're going to take. That's my lie, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, you know, Lars, I think if they really truly feel that, then how about they just pack up and they go live on the border?
Oh, yeah. You know? Well, guess what happens when the border comes to them? The mayor of Washington, D.C., Muriel Bowser, a steadfast, devout Democrat, has been screaming and yelling that there, a crisis has been created by illegal aliens. Martha's Vineyard, which is home to lots of the rich and famous, including Barack Obama, they have actually declared an emergency today because the governor of Florida sent them 2 plane loads of illegal aliens, and they say 50 illegal aliens in a Tony place like Martha's Vineyard creates a crisis. And the mayor of New York City, also a devout Democrat, has been screaming and yelling that it's intolerable that illegal aliens are pouring into New York City, even by the busload. And they seem to not give a damn that a state like Texas is the primary entry point for a couple of million illegal aliens. Not a problem if it's Texas, but if it's D.C. or Chicago or New York or Kamala Harris's house or Martha's Vineyard, all of a sudden it becomes a major emergency.
Yeah, it's a joke. Our current politicians, you know, pretty much across the board are a joke. In my letter to you, my email to you, I actually mentioned that I was, you know, reaching out to the president, the vice president, senators, congressmen, all of them. And I did. And those were some of the things that I actually brought up to them. You know, these drugs, you know, I mean, addicts are always going to find a way, Lars. I'm not naive. You know, they're always going to find a way. There's always going to be something. But we don't have to give the cartels and China, you know, an open invitation to just flood our country and kill our youth.
But we have,
you know,
because we allegedly chose Joe Biden. And he said he wanted, he bragged in the campaign, I'm going to open up the border. I'm going to let people flow in. And he's done. That's one of the few campaign promises he's actually made good on 100%. And the damage is all around us. So the question is, do you think you live in the state of Oregon, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Do you think you're going to get any satisfaction from the congressional delegation that's all Democrats except one, and the senators who are both Democrats except, or and no exceptions there, both Democrats? Do you think they're going to say, why, we have to shut this border and tell that to the president? Because I bet they'd get his attention. Oh, if 6 Democrats said, hey, you got to shut this border, that'd get national headlines.
Realistically, no, but I will tell you what, Lars, you know, especially in election years, I like to make sure that, number one, they know that I'm a registered Republican, and number two, it's an election year, and number three, I have no problem, you know, making, like they do, false promises. You know, I bring all that kind of stuff up, and I'll do whatever I need to do to, you know, try and get them to swing my way, convince them, whatever I need to do. But, you know, I mean, I didn't just reach out to people in the state of Oregon. It was across the board, you know, Texas, California, Washington. I mean, everything, because I feel like especially the Pacific Northwest, we are probably more inundated with these drugs than anywhere else in the country because, number one, our political systems, and number two, the ease of access that we have given our open border proximity.
Well, think about it. A straight pipeline up Interstate 5 to Portland, to Eugene, to Seattle, to Tacoma.
Yeah.
There's a reason. In fact, it kind of stunned me because when I was a street reporter, when I was covering day-to-day news, I knew the value. I knew some numbers, and you know, because you want to know what the lay of the land is. I was stunned the other day when they said, "Yeah, they took down a big seizure of 150,000 fentanyl pills with a value of $750,000." I said, "They're $5 a piece." I said, "It's no wonder that there's an addiction problem because when you're selling the stuff on the street at $5 a pop." I mean, you can't even buy a six-pack of beer for $5 in most cases, and you can buy a fentanyl pill for $5 and get high. And some of this lays on the addicts as well, right?
Yep. Yep, absolutely.
So,
you know, the really sad thing with fentanyl addiction, Lars, have you ever seen anybody?
No, I haven't.
On that?
Nope.
I personally cannot understand the draw for that, because they just sleep. I mean, they're just asleep. That's all
they're
does.
High. But they're, you know, the closest I came, Jody, I've never tried heroin, never had the desire. One time I was in the hospital. They said, "We're giving you a pre-op shot." I said, "What is that?" I think they said 3 grains of morphine. I may remember that right or wrong. And they gave it to me, and I was like, holy cow, you feel like you are flying. So that's the closest I've come, and that was a medical application of it so that they could, you know, cut my foot up. But you know, if that's a taste of what it's like when you get a dose of opioids, I can understand, intellectually anyway, why people decide to go that way. The sad thing is over 100,000 of them are going to die. That's Jody Miller. She's the mother of a fentanyl addict, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. You know, I'm just old enough to remember back when Joe Biden was Vice President of the United States and Barack Hussein Obama, in about the last 12 months of his 8 long years as president, assigned to Joe Biden the job of curing cancer. Now, somehow Joe didn't get it done then, but now he says as president, he's going to have a cancer moonshot. And he gave a speech about it the other day. In fact, he was urging cancer patients, I kid you not, not to jump from the upper balcony. Joe has a strange sense of humor most days of the week. But what's not funny about it is that this so-called cancer moonshot might actually make it harder for the companies that are developing life-saving drugs for people with cancer to be able to do something about it. It might actually make it harder for those drugs to come about. Jack Calvernitos joins us now, executive director for the CPAC Coalition Against Socialized Medicine. Jack, it's good to have you back on the program.
I really appreciate being back. This is a very, very timely topic this week, so thank you.
Well, and with all the other things going on, you know, the pending rail strike that didn't happen, and Joe stepped into the last minute and solved it, it's like they're trying to cast him as the be-all and end-all for just about every problem in America, even though I see him as the cause of most of the problems in America. Well, let's get right to the cancer drugs. So we have a moonshot program that's supposed to lead to cures to cancer, which I thought the pharma industry had been pursuing for literally decades, but now somehow, by having the federal government step in to help out, they're actually going to make it harder. Can you describe for my audience how that's going to be?
Yeah, and you know, you actually are the only person I've heard in the media, and maybe I'm just not, you know, watching the right places or listening to the right people, but to actually, you know, mention that event where, you know, he's talking to cancer patients and he jokes about people not jumping from the rafters. From the balcony. I mean, it can't be explained away as, well, this is, you know, good old Joe, you know, telling a joke. It was just absurd. So on top of the absurdity of having a cancer moonshot event within days of him having screamed at Labor Day, "We beat pharma, we beat pharma." I mean, where's the empathy to patients? And then who does he think is going to be developing these drugs?
I guess he kind of suggests in one way that it'll be the government, because I remind people all the time, the government doesn't really make or do anything. And they say, well, we fight wars. I said, yes, with volunteers and weapons made by private industry. You know, so every time you give the government credit for something, you say, yeah, that only came about because of private sector efforts. But he's going to have a brand new government health agency that's supposed to drive all these treatment breakthroughs. How's that going to happen? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, well, it's not. You are right. And, you know, the Wall Street Journal did a great piece yesterday, basically highlighting that you know, Biden gave this speech, and yet here we are right on the cusp of a very significant advancement in cancer-fighting drugs, is Amgen's Lumakras. And what's interesting about this is that it's actually a drug that can get to lung cancer tumors, which to this day, and I don't think people realize this, it's the number one cause of death from any cancer. And yet they make the case, the editors make the case, that it takes $2 to $3 billion with a B dollars for pharmaceutical companies to develop a brand new blockbuster drug. And if Medicare, which is the largest payer for healthcare on the face of the earth that insurers follow, if they decide to, which they are now required to do, to actually have price controls and rationing, there are going to be a lot of drugs that aren't developed because companies are going to do the math and say, it's just not worth it for us.
That's the thing I've been trying, Jack, I've been trying to persuade people. They say there has to be something that limits the amount that's charged for pills. And I said, hold on. You ask somebody to put $2-3 billion into something, and that's the same number I've used. Then you tell them it's going to take 12 to 14 years to develop the drug and get it to market. And then after that, you've got maybe 6-7 years that it's still under copyright or patent before it becomes, you know, off over the, you know, over the, not over the counter, but it becomes public domain. So you can no longer make money on it as the inventor of the drug, because the patent actually starts when you first start working on the drug, but you may not get it to market for a dozen years. And you've got to somehow recoup the $2 or $3 billion in the sales you're going to make in the next 5 or 6 years. You got to charge a lot for every single pill, or you'll never make the money back. And if they don't make the money back, then the company's going to say, why should we do it?
Yeah, and I think that some Americans, and you know, I don't think many Americans think a lot about this issue, but they get confused and fooled. They get fooled because the media has gone along with the Democratic talking points that what this is going to be about is Medicare negotiation. And you know, as Americans, who is against negotiating? You want to negotiate for a car, you go to Europe, you want to negotiate for a nice belt on the street in Italy or something, or Greece, where my grandparents came from. But actually what it is price controls. It's saying we're only going to pay this amount, and if you don't charge us that below market amount, we're not going to buy from you. You know, in most countries, the government is the sole purchaser of pharmaceuticals. So it's not the rest of the world where pharmaceutical companies are going to be making their money. And because our country is significantly still wealthier than most other countries, I'm looking at some stats here, we're 46% richer than the British and 36% more than the Germans, that the U.S. is still the number one market. And so if we are now going to have price controls on our drugs in the number one market that pharma sells to, they will be making economic decisions that not only put us at risk and our parents and people's grandparents, but actually citizens around the world. I mean, it's actually a global issue by him making this single decision for election year politics.
And Jack, if they say, well, why is this drug $2 in Canada or Great Britain and it's $20 here? And you say, well, because we haven't said to those countries, you can't buy it for less or substantially less than what our people can buy it for. And if they did that, then the drug company could say, I can sell it to you for $10, but only if I sell it to Americans for $12. You know, that might be workable. But when the differences are so big and they're driven by fairly wealthy countries, we're not necessarily talking about India or Pakistan. We're not talking about, you know, Sudan having to pay. We can do charity for that if we choose to do that. But you could say, we're not going to allow these gigantic discounts to everybody else in the world and then make Americans carry all the freight. And then when nobody's willing to carry the freight, then they just don't make the drugs at all.
Yeah, they don't make it at all. You know, Sally Pipes with the Pacific Research Survey, you know, Pacific Research Council has a survey, and it says something that we all don't say enough about, which is people in this country, unlike in Britain, let's say, we're actually satisfied or very satisfied with our health care. And they put out a poll where it shows employed, unemployed, retired, 50 plus, under 50. And for all of them, for every one of those categories, the vast majority of people say that they're generally satisfied. And, you know, even though retail prices for brand new blockbuster drugs, if you were to pay full retail out of your pocket, that's a big cost. I mean, it's sometimes it's outrageously big. But as Americans, very few of us do that because we have insurance. We yep. pay a copay of it. And then 90% of the drugs that we end up taking are actually generic because they're off of patent. And we actually are paying the exact same amount as people around the world because we're taking those, you know, generic drugs. So there's just so many misnomers. And in this sort of murky sea of complexity of drug pricing and the misnomers and the false information, you have the Biden administration, the Democrats, trying to score political points by fooling people into, we're here to help you with inflation. We're going to pass this bill and we're going to pat ourselves on the back of the White House lawn.
Jack Calavratinos, who is the executive director of the CPAC Coalition Against Socialized Medicine. Jack, it's a pleasure. Back in a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday and live on the Radio Northwest Network. This segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles. You pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Would you send your kids to a college that requires racial indoctrination to graduate? Portland State University is doing exactly that. You cannot graduate from PSU without having taken something from the Race and Ethnic Studies Department that includes Queer Families is the name of one course, Prejudice, Privilege, and Power, Introduction to Black Studies, or Black Feminism and Womanism. I'd say no. Save your tuition dollars. Spend them somewhere else would be my point of view. But that's how woke things have become. Yesterday, I told you how the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare is now mandating a porn literacy curriculum to elementary school age children down to third grade, which means kids 8 years of age will be taught about porn literacy. And I asked in the question yesterday, should public schools be teaching porn literacy to elementary age kids? 96% of you joined me in a no vote on that. Only 4% of you said yes. Today's Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. To your calls, let's go first to Patty. Hey, Patty, thanks for listening in Medford on the Radio Northwest Network and KMED. What's on your mind?
Well, I need to back up to the discussion we were having on Solana House. My husband and I are 80, and we live in a manufactured home in a really nice park in town. But because of our age, we're moving out of there, and we have built a small house just right for us. Well, the ownership of our park has changed, and anybody who moves into the park from this day forward will be paying $895 a month for rent.
Yep.
Well, who can afford that? I mean, one of the reasons for living in a manufactured home is cost.
Yep.
And so the dilemma that has not happened to us, but it has to others, is that we have two people who are getting by quite nicely on their Social Security.
Sure.
One of them dies, and they no longer have enough money to pay this exorbitant rent.
Well, is it exorbitant, though, Patty, or is it the marketplace? Because
it's the market, but it is a falling market right now. Because
Patty, I've owned houses. I've also rented. But when I own a house, I own the property under it. I own the structure itself. I own all of it. If you own a mobile manufactured home, you own the building. You don't own the land under it. And while that is inexpensive at some times, it can become very expensive because you haven't controlled what you're going to have to pay for. If you buy a house outright, all you've got to worry about is the taxes and your fellow voters who love to vote for tax levies. But if you say, I'm going to own a house, but it's on a piece of property I don't own, you kind of put yourself at the mercy of the landlord and the marketplace, haven't you?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Well, how would you fix it? Do you have a fix for it? Because I think most of the fixes are talking about taking away somebody else's property rights. In other words, saying, you, the landlord, can only charge me so much.
I guess I want to appeal to somebody's heart, but I know that hearts and dollars don't really mix. But we're paying $550 right now. But when we leave, when we move out of that house and somebody else moves in, the price goes to $895. There we go.
Yep, goes up. It doesn't quite double. But let me ask you something. Let's say the somebody else that you're paying to, you know, the evil landlord is always seen by as somebody with a big mustache twirling it going, I'm sitting here rich. But here, that is the adage, oh, those evil landlords, they've got suitcases full of $100 bills. What if the people who own that park or invested in it are themselves retired? And they say, hey, we bought this mobile park and we've had to put a ton of money into it and we didn't make much money on it for a long time, but now it's our retirement. And you say, well, we're going to steal part of your retirement by saying you can only charge so much to the people who are renting from you. And you say, you mean I can't charge whatever the market will bear and you're going to take part of my retirement away?
Well, part of it is that the state says that a landlord can raise the rent on a manufactured home only a certain percentage until whoever owns that house sells it. Then they can do whatever they please.
That's true.
You know, we're just kind of we're at the mercy of them. And the only thing that, you know, I would suggest is just let it continue like it was. They're making money at the 570 level.
Now, hold on. Would you do that, Patty? I mean, if you
let's say
yes. For example,
yes,
a couple of years ago, the money you had in savings was earning how much interest every year?
Very little.
A quarter of a point, maybe.
Yeah.
You know what passbook is going for these days?
You know, I don't even know.
About 2.5%. So maybe 10 times as much interest as it was just a couple of years ago. If you parked your money in a savings account, you'd get this statement at the end of the year saying, you made 52 cents in interest. And you say, wow, I won't spend it all in one place. Here's the thing.
Yeah.
If somebody said to you, Patty, you're making bank on your savings now, you should give a bunch of that back. In the interest of other people. Would you do it?
No,
I wouldn't either. And Patty, I think that's the answer to your question. Glad to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Don't forget tomorrow, First Amendment Friday, and next week we're live from Washington, D.C. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back
Oregon
to
Utility
Lars
Notification
Larson
Center
Show.
Wants
it's a
to remind
pleasure
you
to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone
tree,
calls and emails.
A fence,
glad to have you with me on the Radio Northwest Network
home,
as well. As I mentioned
click
yesterday, we've added a new affiliate.
To get
we
the
cover
area
Oregon,
marked.
Washington, and
then
Idaho.
Dig safely,
we're always glad to welcome new ones to the party, and that's
Talk
Radio in
Forks,
Washington, on the Olympic Peninsula.
Call
glad to have you
dig.
On board as well.
For more
and
information,
your calls
visit us
too,
online
at 866-HEY-LARS.
That's 866-439-5277.
Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Is the left side of politics unsure as to why Washington State is spending billions of its tax dollars on climate change? Todd Myers joins me now, Environmental Director at the Washington Policy Center. Todd, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me on.
So what exactly is going on here? They've got tax policy, or not tax policies, pollution policies, so-called, that are aimed at CO2, which a lot of us don't think is a pollutant at all. But they're not quite sure why they're spending all those dollars to get some minuscule benefit out of it.
Well, that's right. And so there's a couple of examples of that recently that I thought worth highlighting. The first one is the big federal spending bill that it was supposed to reduce inflation, but of course they admit now that it won't reduce inflation, but they say, okay, that's okay. It helps fight climate change and reduce CO2 emissions. But when you look at actually the metrics of how people assess, you know, what's being done and whether it's working, it tends to be how much they're spending. Does it actually work? Does it get a lot of bang for the buck? You rarely see that mentioned. What you see people mention is, look how much money we are spending. If you really care about solving a problem, you will measure results, not money, but that's not what you see. The other example is in Vancouver, where you live, where they are looking at a climate action plan. And in that, they said that for this $9 million a year that they want to spend on a climate action plan, they will get $13 million in climate benefits. And setting aside whether that $13 million is accurate, I asked them, well, who gets that $13 million? And they said, well, the people of Vancouver. And that's simply wrong. What their own study or what their own source says is that is $13 million in global benefits, of which Vancouver will get a tiny fraction, maybe a couple of $100 worth of that benefit. So even the people who are making these plans don't understand who, what the costs are and who benefits, and yet they keep pushing forward with a lot of these policies.
Well, and when you say global benefits, you mean if we do this here, it'll have this tiny benefit, but if you want to make the benefits seem larger, then you say, well, we'll extend the benefits to every place on planet Earth. And at that point, it looks like something substantial that you're saving. If you assume that if you do it here in somewhere in Washington state, that it'll have a benefit in China and in Russia and in Western Europe. And when you count all that together, it's actually worth doing it.
That's right. So, you know, what Vancouver does makes a very, very tiny impact on total global temperatures. But if you multiply that impact by 7 billion people, well, then you can actually get a number that looks like it's meaningful. But again, for the people of Vancouver, they are spending $9 million a year to get, you know, a tiny amount of that benefit, literally, you know, a couple of $100. So it is all for the benefit of the rest of the world. Now, again, you can argue about whether that $13 million number is right or wrong. I think there's some things. But the key point is, they don't even understand the argument that they are making or the calculations. They are simply justifying the policy because they want it, and the benefits are sort of an afterthought.
Well, and to a large extent, let me throw this in. If you're saying we're doing this to benefit the whole globe by reducing CO2 output, and you say, so China is one of the beneficiaries. I mean, there are 1.5 billion people there. And you say, but China's building coal-fired electric power plants to beat the ban. And you've got India doing the same kind of thing. And you've got Mexico, which is also not meeting up to our standards. But we're going to spend a lot of money here to benefit people in other parts of the planet that aren't even doing what we're doing for the planet.
Yeah, and I think you know, what their response to that would be is, well, but they're poor. We should give them some slack to get up to our level, but we have to do our part. Okay, I think there's some merit to that argument. I think that they can take that argument too far. But you're exactly right. If you don't focus on the results, right, what you're doing making a difference, then you actually don't care about solving the problem. And if all you're doing is giving leeway to other people to undo the good that you have done, and you pay all the costs and they receive all the benefits, at the very least, you should be honest about that. And I think a lot of the people who support these climate policies can't be candid or don't even realize that that's the case.
I'm talking to Todd Myers from the Washington Policy Center. The other thing, let me throw this in because you know this issue well, but when the U.S. government takes a look at transit projects, they will say to a transit agency, whether it's light rail or buses, they'll say, okay, how much is your cost per rider? Well, you have to figure out how much is the bus or the train that we're putting in going to cost? And then you say, how many people are going to ride it? That, again, is an estimate of what it will be. And you say, now divide the total operating cost and capital cost over a period of years by the number of people who are going to ride it. And you come up with a number. And the transit or the transportation folks at the federal level especially will say, well, let's see, Minneapolis's program is going to cost $20 per rider per ride. And the light rail in Seattle is going to cost $50 per rider per ride. At least it gives you an apples to apples comparison. So you can say, sounds like the Minneapolis one is better than the one in Seattle or Portland or wherever. That's a way of making those comparisons. If you don't do those comparisons, say, well, how much is this methane recapture at landfills going to save? It's $10 to capture methane. And if you do this other project, it's $200 per ton of captured CO2 or methane. Okay, it sounds like the $10 one is more bang for the buck. That's what you're talking about, right?
That's exactly right. And oftentimes we don't even do those calculations. We just simply make assumptions about, well, here are the things we're going to do. We know that they will, you know, reduce some amount of CO2, but the cost to benefit analysis is not very convenient because the numbers are bad. So in many cases, they don't do it. In other cases, they simply make it up. In Spokane, their climate action plan, they had an assessment of what they called social benefits. Now, what social benefits was very vague, but they put out a report that said that if they did their climate action plan, it would receive, you know, on a scale of 4, it was a 3. It would increase social benefits by 3 out of 4. So I emailed them and said, what are you even measuring? I don't know what a social benefit is. What 3 out of 4 what's? And they said, well, 3 out of 4. And they would never tell me what they were even measuring. And then what it turned out is they just simply made it up. They just simply, it was a pure made up number that meant nothing. So a lot of these, especially at the city level, you see these sorts of things where either they don't know what they're talking about, what their own sources say, or they, to avoid that problem, they just simply make them up. And I just think it shows an unseriousness about the problem they claim is an existential crisis.
Oh, and Todd, I know what I call it when somebody lies to get money. We call that fraud. I mean, the generic term for it is fraud or scam. That is Todd Myers, who's the environmental director of the Washington Policy Center. In a moment, we've got a new Jim Gossett song on the Green New Deal and a few other crazy things that Democrats have been up to. We'll get to that in your phone calls and emails. You're listening to Conspiracy Theory Thursday on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Green New Deal is a total scam. Taxpayers, it is gonna slam. It's just a giant money grab. Bankrupt the country while we all pay the tab.
Take it away, Bernie.
Electric cars you can't afford to drive. Economy will fight to stay alive. Destruction will be far and wide. We'll be suffering because Joe Manchin lied. Windmills can't drill. EVs, huge fees. How did it pass? Goodbye, cars with gas. Green New Deal is a joke.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. That's our great parody guy, Jim Gossett, the incomparable Jim Gossett. Glad to be with you and always glad to take your calls, and I'll get to those in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. I have to tell you something. The Democrats are in a total panic right now. Now, in the last few weeks, on Capitol Hill, where they are almost certain to lose control of the House, probably the Senate as well, the Democrats have made all kinds of statements. They said, we're going to vote on gay marriage then. We're going to put gay marriage into federal law because they're afraid, because of some comments made by Supreme Court Justice and the best of the nine, Clarence Thomas, who said, abortion was not in the Constitution. We finally realized that, and gay marriage isn't in there either. So the Democrats said, we're going to vote on gay marriage then, and we're going to do it before the midterm election. Well, we just found out today the Democrats have said, I think we're going to do that after the election because they understood Americans don't support it. And that's the bottom line for members of Congress. If you go out and vote for bills that your constituents do not support, you're going to be finding yourself a new job. And there's going to be somebody in your place who is, well, if you're currently a Republican, you're probably a rhino. You'll be replaced by a conservative. And if you're a Democrat, you'll be replaced by a conservative. That's basically the way it goes. So the Democrats have become more and more panicked by what is coming at them in November. I'll give you one example. I'll actually give you a few examples. Hank Johnson is a member of Congress. He is a black American, and he launched an attack because he tried to say, and this is what's crazy, there are a lot of reasons for parents to show up at school board meetings unhappy about the way their schools are being run because their kids are being indoctrinated to porn literacy like the kids in Idaho. Pornography literacy is being taught and will be pushed on kids as young as 8 years of age. You've got parents who show up because, in one case, a man's daughter was raped in a school bathroom by a trans student. In other words, a boy wearing a dress who claims to be a girl who went into the school restroom and raped this man's daughter. He showed up mad at the school board meeting. And what happens? The Department of Justice decides to declare that angry parents who get too loud at school board meetings, they're a threat to America. They are like domestic terrorists. Well, a Democrat member of the slavery party since 1828, Hank Johnson, Democrat member of Congress, has decided to put on par you angry parents showing up at school board meetings with the incident that happened at the Capitol building involving riot by a few hundred people, but he says that parents showing up mad at the school board meeting are the same as rioters at the Capitol building January 6th of last year. Listen to what he said.
It was a day that we'll never forget. And people on the local level at affected school board meetings, they won't forget the MAGA Republicans descending on their school board meetings after January 6th, like January 6th, disrupting meetings. It was a coordinated attack happening across the country.
Yeah, so now all of a sudden, rioters at the Capitol building, some of whom have been held without trial for well over a year, like you'd be held in some kind of third world dictatorship or China or Russia if you become a political enemy of the state, they're being compared to angry parents showing up at a school board meeting with reasonable objections to critical race theory, to indoctrination, to porn literacy, things like that. So they're telling you basically don't get mad. And then you've got Rand Paul, member of the Senate, Senator Rand Paul, who's a medical doctor himself, who has been after Dr. Anthony Fauci for a good long time. And he was actually asking a relatively reasonable question. How many of the people who've been evaluating these COVID vaccines have a dog in the fight? How many of them are getting some kind of royalty or payment from the companies that make the vaccines? In other words, do those doctors have a dog in the fight? Listen to that exchange.
We've been asking you, and you refuse to answer, whether anybody on the vaccine committees gets royalties from the pharmaceutical companies. I asked you last time, and what was your response? We don't have to tell you.
Right.
We've demanded them through Freedom of Information Act, and what have you said? We're not going to tell you. But I tell you this, when we get in charge, we're going to change the rules, and you will have to divulge where you get your royalties from what companies, and if anybody on the committee has a conflict of interest, we're going to learn about it. I promise you that.
That is Senator Rand Paul dressing down Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's leaving. He'll have the biggest federal pension in American history, bar none. And then you've got the issue of abortion. All the Supreme Court said, so they didn't outlaw abortion. They just said it's up to the states. Well, Mazie Hirono, who is a senator, the U.S. senator, one of the two from the great state of Hawaii, goes on the floor of the Senate and starts talking in a way that usually the Democrats condemn you if you engage in some kind of violent talk. Well, take a listen to Mazie Hirono.
This is an outright attack on women in this country and those who support our right to make decisions about our own bodies. That is how we see it. And why? Because that's what's happening. Madam President, I yield the floor, but clearly, you know, this is a literally call to arms.
Literally.
In our country.
Not figuratively, literally a call to arms. Now, that would sound scary, except that every time I hear a Democrat talk about call to arms, I realize that most of the Democrats don't own any guns. They don't even know which end the bullet comes out of. So call to arms when it comes to Democrats is less scary than it would be otherwise. And then finally, there's this. As you may have heard, two busloads of illegal aliens sent from Texas by Governor Greg Abbott were dropped off at the house of Vice President Kamala Harris, the woman designated as the border czar by Joe Biden. And of course, just a few days ago, Vice President Harris was asked, how about the 2 million people who've crossed into the country illegally? And her answer to Chuck Todd on NBC News was, oh no, our border is secure. Well, somebody thought, and it was a great idea, why don't we ask some of the illegals dropped off at Kamala's house this morning whether they think the border is open or not? Listen to this.
Vice President Harris said that the border is closed. Do you believe that the border is closed or is it open?
It's open, not closed. The border is open.
The border is open. Do you believe that all the migrants believe that the border is open?
Yeah, everybody believes that the border is open. It's open because we enter. We come in free. No problem. Yeah, we came illegally, not legal.
Yeah, we came in free, no problem at the border. Illegally, of course, not legal. I mean, even this illegal alien realizes what he's doing is illegal. He realizes the border is open, but somehow the Vice President of the United States, who has never been the sharpest tool in the shed, she doesn't get it, but the illegal aliens that she and Joe are letting in, they get it. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com on the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment. But I want to put an issue in front of you. If you run a private organization like a university, and you decide that the university has certain standards, especially a religious university, should you be able to hold those standards on your campus as well? Well, at Yeshiva University, they had decided, the university had decided, we're not going to welcome an LGBTQ group on campus. And why? Because their beliefs clearly violate our closely held religious beliefs. And as I understood the Supreme Court's decisions over the years, going all the way back to the Boy Scouts of America, the Supreme Court had held that if you're a private organization, not a public accommodation, not a lunch counter, not a hotel, not anything like that, but you're a private organization, you're going to have standards that you set up based on the beliefs of that organization. Now, Rabbi Yaakov Menken and I have talked about this a couple of times in the last month or so. He is the managing director of the Coalition for Jewish Values, which is the largest rabbinic public policy organization in America. Rabbi, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So as you know, I sent you a note because last week I was celebrating because one of the most liberal members of the U.S. Supreme Court, Sonia Sotomayor, had given Yeshiva University a yes, saying you don't have to accommodate this group. And then the full Supreme Court weighs in and apparently says, yes, you do. Give me a perspective on this, if you would, please.
Well, I can tell you that I've had a lawyer tell me that he's livid, and I've had a lawyer tell me that this is really not very important at all. But the bottom line seems to be that, yes, Sotomayor was right to grant them relief, but at the same time, there are certain procedures that are supposed to be followed, and SCOTUS is very much, the Supreme Court is very much into following procedure and doing things, quote-unquote, the right way. So the decision that came from the full Supreme Court is you were supposed to go through the New York system. You're supposed to go to the New York Supreme Court, which, in a bizarre twist of New York governance, is down below the Court of Appeals.
What?
And then you actually get, that's the actual New York's highest court. And then, okay. Yeah, then once you've exhausted all of your options in the state of New York, come back to us. But they did leave the door open to come back. They just said it has to be done in this way. The big question and the problem is, how much time is there before the opening of the semester at which point Yeshiva University could be held in contempt of court if they don't get a new stay from a lower court? How much time do they have to obtain one? How much time do they have to get back to the Supreme Court? It's unfortunate because the Supreme Court is standing on procedure in a situation where they're basically saying, well, this might abrogate your religious rights for now, but we'll come back and fix it later.
Yeah, except that later, Rabbi, I mean, if I imagine the process, you go to the New York Supreme Court, I'm guessing months at least, if not years. Then you go to the New York Court of Appeals, the highest court in the state, bizarre, as you said, bizarrely. And then they say that they're going to turn you down as well. And I would expect they would because they're a state court and they're going to hew to the politics of the state. And then after that, you get to go to the federal courts. And I assume they're going to want you to come up through the federal courts, first to the federal district courts and then to the federal court of appeals. And then finally, and this sounds like, I mean, in lawyer time, this sounds like years is going to go by or could go by before it finally gets back to the Supreme Court. They say, yeah, it turns out your rights were violated and we've let them be violated for the last several years.
There is something called an emergency stay. They can potentially get an emergency hearing within a week on their request for a stay pending appeal that says, okay, we recognize that this is going to be litigated. We realize they have a case here. We're not going to force them to do it until they had the opportunity to appeal the decision, which, of course, is the right way to go. The question is how quickly they can get it. That's why I say that emergency stay. But what you just described is the way the left is using litigation to either bankrupt their target. I mean, look at Jack Phillips of Masterpiece Cake Shop out in Colorado.
Yep.
Or to force people to go through hoops of litigation after litigation after litigation just to defend a basic right which 20 years ago nobody would have asked this question.
Well, and you and I have talked about the fact that it's weird. I think it's weird for any interest group to say we're going to deliberately go to a you know, a university in this case, a religious university, and say, you must change your most closely held religious beliefs to accommodate what we believe. To which I think almost anybody would say, well, that's not reasonable. They're a religious organization. They enjoy the protection of the First Amendment and the right to practice your religion in the United States. How can you go in and force them to do that? And they say, watch us. Hold our beer. Here we go.
Right now, the progressive left is anything but reasonable. They're not interested in being reasonable. I think we may have discussed this in a previous conversation about this, but it's very clear these were 18-year-old, at minimum, students coming into that university. So either this idea that being gay is an identity is completely false because they didn't have it before and they figured it out when they got to university, or if they want to claim that it's an identity characteristic, it means that they went to Yeshiva University knowing exactly what the university stood for, and they intended to change the way it operates, that there should be no refuge for a person to learn secular topics in a religious environment, a secular university that operates by traditional standards and not progressive ones. They're trying to
Rabbi,
get rid of that through litigation that's anything but reasonable.
Rabbi, doesn't this have implications for every other religious organization in the country? I mean, not just universities, but any kind of religious organization.
Well, of course, and the litigation is being done deliberately. It is actually very much related, you know, the Masterpiece Cake Shop. As soon as he won his case that he doesn't have to bake a cake to celebrate a gay marriage, which he just can't, you know, he can't do that because it doesn't comport with his beliefs. And imagine, by the way, you're trying to coerce somebody to do something where he has, you know, he would naturally do a terrible job. You ask him to do creative effort, decorate a cake for something he finds repugnant. Why would you ever do that in any circumstance? No reasonable person would do that. Well, okay, now we go to Baylor University, where they say that it's discriminating against LGBTQ students because, again, they don't have the clubs, they don't have the, you know, and there they're trying to threaten the scientific education funding. So, of course, this has implications for other universities, even ones that declare themselves to be religious, Christian in the case of Baylor, that they shouldn't get science education funding.
Yeah, because of this, because they want to force the government into a position where the government allows, even endorses, discrimination on the basis of your religious beliefs.
They want to push religion out of the public sphere. You want to be religious, you have to hide in your synagogue or your church or your other house of worship. You're not allowed out into the street, because as soon as you do something in the public eye, I mean, as I said about, you know, last year, the Equality Act declared it an act of discrimination to separate men and women. Well, according to that, my daughter's wedding in February was a bias crime.
Unbelievable. Rabbi Yaakov Menken is the managing director of the Coalition for Jewish Values. Rabbi, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. The U.S. Supreme Court, 5-4 vote, rejected an emergency request made by Yeshiva University. But understand, it has implications for every person of every faith. Back in a moment, your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. It's the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on what we call Conspiracy Theory Thursday. This segment brought to you by Valhalla Tea Company. It's made by veterans to help veterans by donating $1 from every bag sold at ValhallaTea.com. That's ValhallaTea.com. I want to read this letter, and then I'll get to your calls. Ron Galbadini writes in. Actually, I got that wrong. Ron Galdabini. Sorry about that, Ron. Pristine Waldo Lake, the gem of the Oregon Cascades, protected by preservationists to the point of banning gas-powered boats, no boat traveling over 10 miles an hour, etc., to protect the pristine waters of the lake, is no longer pristine. The United States Forest Service, after diddling around a small fire since August the 1st that was outside the Waldo Lake Wilderness Area, has let this small lightning fire in a roaded area, meaning you can get firefighters into it, explode to not only open national forest land, but into the Waldo Lake Wilderness Area and Waldo Lake Watershed. So much for keeping the waters of Waldo Lake pristine and pure. The story of this fire and the total incompetence of the Forest Service is not controlling this blaze, and it needs to be told to the public. Do not believe the news releases of the USFS about steep, inaccessible terrain. Pull up Google Earth and fire maps and show where the fire started and the many roads in the area. See the signs of timber harvest activities carried out by ground-based tracked equipment clearly evident on Google Earth photos. That is clear evidence the terrain is not all that steep, inaccessible, or hazardous to work in. I worked for the U.S. Forest Service for more than 35 years, so, Lars, as you say, I still have a dog in this situation, signed Ron. Ron, thanks for the call. To your calls, let's go to Steve. Steven, welcome to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. You know, I'm 64 years old, and I've been on oxycodone for 20 years.
Wow.
Try to control the pain. The doctors can't figure out what's wrong. I've been to so many doctors. I've tried so many things, acupuncture, everything. Nothing works. And that lady that had called about her 21-year-old son, I feel sorry for her, but it isn't easy to get oxycodone. I mean, every 3 months I have a urine test. I go to a special pain doctor just to get it. It's now not enough to even control the pain. It doesn't even curve the pain. I'm sitting here now in so much pain, and I just took an oxycodone 2 hours ago. I'm on 60 milligrams a day.
Wow.
And I'm sorry, but the government has screwed this up so bad that the doctors are so afraid to give oxycodone, and that lady says that he gets it from doctors at emergency room. Give me that doctor's name. I mean, this is insane.
Well,
anyway,
I think we bounced all the way from one extreme to the other. Stephen, I've had friends who told me that their parents had, say, open heart surgery where their chest gets cracked open, and there's a considerable amount of pain. My father-in-law has done that, and they were given, 30, 35, 40 years ago, they were given ibuprofen and told, yeah, it's going to be tough. This will take the edge off of it. Deal with it. And then we went all the way to the other extreme, which was dose everybody up with everything. And we'll be free and easy. And in about 10 years ago, they began to really clamp down, and you felt the pain, literally, of that clamp down. And I think the happy medium somewhere in between, Stephen, and I'm with you. But the addiction problem in this country is huge. Let me go to Michael. Michael, thanks for listening in Kennewick on KONA, one of our great Radio Northwest affiliates. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to discuss a little bit about Representative Hank Johnson.
Hank Johnson.
That was comparing the students or the parents for school board meetings to the January 6th debacle.
Yep, he sure did.
Isn't he the same one that was concerned that Guam was going to tip over?
I thought that was a different rep from the Democrat Party, but none of them are very bright.
That is true. I had to listen to Hank Johnson's speech.
No, it was. That was actually Hank Johnson. I just looked it up. We talked about it. That happened, 12 years ago. His quote was, "My fear is that if we moved too many of the U.S. Marines from Okinawa to Guam," quote, "my fear is that the whole nation, our island, will become so overpopulated that it will tip over and capsize." And it was clear from the way he said it, he was not joking at all.
No, it was not joking. But that just shows you the mentality of the people that are elected.
Well, not just people who are elected, but in this case, do you think that we have a problem with the Democrat Party? Because I'll cite one from today. You know that they dropped off a bunch of illegal aliens in not only at the vice president's house, but also on Martha's Vineyard. On Martha's Vineyard, this is millionaires and billionaires and Barack Obama who live on Martha's Vineyard. It's a very, very exclusive neighborhood. And when reporters asked Karine Jean-Pierre, who is the spokeswoman for Joe Biden, about this, she said, "These people deserve a fate better than to be abandoned on Martha's Vineyard. And I thought, you've just been dropped off in one of the most expensive and exclusive neighborhoods anywhere in America, and you're bemoaning the fact that, oh, the humanity, these poor illegal aliens, why they've been dropped off in an incredibly rich neighborhood. It's horrible, isn't it?
Yeah, they could probably support them with the change they find in the couch.
Yeah, they probably could. Probably not a bad place to do what the kids call spanging, which is asking for spare change. But, George, you're right. It was Hank Johnson not only comparing January 6th rioters to angry school board parents at a meeting, but also worried about Guam tipping over if it got too many people on it. You've got the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.